the whole business into the corridor, which exertion reminded him that his hip was sore and likely to be downright painful in a day or two. He set the empty buckets outside the door as well, and gave himself up to a moment of resentment. He resented being married, resented having to think of a wife, share a room with a wife, consider her social priorities, and send her notes. Listening to Charlotte humming softly behind the privacy screen, Sherborne resented all the servants who knew he'd abandoned the lady of the manor for dinner more often than he'd joined her. He resented the weather, which would go from bad to worse to awful. He resented Brantford, who couldn't be bothered to spend a night under the roof of a business associate, but must instead prevail on his grace of have a title for accommodations. "Your turn," Charlotte said, emerging from the privacy screen. "I left you some warm water, though you hardly need it."
"The sheets."
"No matter." She unbelted her robe, and damned if the woman wasn't naked. "I'm sure we'll be quite cozy in no time." She climbed under the covers, depriving him of an opportunity to gawk, for now, but he'd glimpsed a slim haunch, the curve of her breast. Sherborne used his tooth powder and blew out the candles, but he didn't bank the fire. Charlotte had said she wanted to see his eyes, or some damned nonsense to that effect, so a little illumination was basic husbandly consideration. He shrugged out of his dressing gown and draped it over a chair.
"My hair is still damp."
"All the more reason for you to get under the covers, lest you take a chill. You seem to have the constitution of a bull, but tempting fate is for fools." Sherborne got under the covers, the sheets cool rather than frigid. He considered waiting until morning to make love with his wife. They were both tired, the hour was late. He wasn't at his best. But in the morning, he'd be off to the colliery, arguing with Jones about moving a row of houses that should probably never have been laid out at the foot of the hill.
"Lucas."
He found Charlotte's hand beneath the covers and brought her fingers to his lips.
"You're sure?"
She tucked herself along his side.
"I'm more sure by the moment."
Sherborne draped himself over his wife and kissed her. His hip hurt, which was good, because a little pain would offer a distraction when a distraction was needed. Charlotte kissed him back, which was very good. He needed her kisses. He needed the pleasure he could share with her while he forgot, for one blessed private hour, the tons of mud that had destroyed his schedule, his budget, and some of his confidence. As Charlotte took his hand and tucked it over her breast, Sherborne spared one last thought for his commercial undertakings. He, who thrived on a challenge and had schemed for years to bring mining into the valley, resented his colliery. He resented his colliery mightily. Charlotte considered letting Sherborne drift off to sleep, or, more likely, lie beside her, fretting over his tenant houses, tram lines, and business associations. Two thoughts stopped her from pursuing that course. First, she refused to yield the very consummation of her vows to the press of business. Beginning as she intended to go on in the marriage meant that in this instance she was owed her husband's attention at the time and place of her choosing, exactly as he'd promised. The second thought that weighed against allowing Sherborne his rest was the growing realization of how alone he was, and how much responsibility he carried. Finding a set of widow's weeds for a ruined laundress, or scraping together a few pounds for coach fare, had been significant accomplishments in Charlotte's eyes. Sherborne sought to employ scores of people to provide sustenance for many families, and this was only one of his ventures. He deserved a respite from his obligations. He deserved one place where business could not intrude, and where his satisfaction mattered.
"You make a lovely quilt," Charlotte said, "all warm and friendly."
Sherborne nuzzled her ear, which tickled.
"I don't believe I've ever been accused of friendliness."
The texture of his chest hairs against Charlotte's bare skin was peculiar, his beard slightly abrasive. Blunt warmth nudged against her thigh. Should I be doing something? Sherborne rested his forehead against her shoulder.
You and I are alike in this regard. We worry less when we're busy. You should be enjoying yourself.
Difficult to do, when uncertainty and arousal were evenly matched. I liked it when you... Charlotte could not say the words. She was naked in bed with her husband, and she could not say the words.
Show me.
She took his hand and closed his fingers around her nipple, not too hard, but not too lightly either.
As it happens, Sherborne said, we both enjoy that. Let's try something.
In the next moment, he had her atop him, which meant Charlotte was more or less sitting on a particularly tumid part of his anatomy, and her abundant glories were on display, and Sherborne was admiring them. He smoothed his hands over her breasts, filling his palms, and curling up to press his face between them, rough beard and all. Charlotte wrapped a hand around his head, his hair warm and damp where it had been against the pillow, cool where it grazed her breasts.
"Shall I use my mouth?" Sherborne asked. "Did you like that, too?"
"This is not an interview, Mr. Sherborne." He laughed and hugged her, the sensation of bare skin tightly pressed to bare skin, a lovely shock.
"You are modest and passionate," he said.
"An inconvenient combination for you, I'm sure.
What if I bumble along as best I can, and you let me know if I've chosen the wrong direction?"
Charlotte put his hand back on her breast. "That will suit." His bumbling was an entrancing progression of kisses, caresses, and suggestions. Charlotte was to touch him, too, apparently, for he used her third finger to draw light circles around his nipple, and when she added a slight pinch and a scrape of her fingernail, he arched into her touch. All the while, his arousal was evident against her sex, a hot, hard, intimate promise all its own. Charlotte cast about for how to form a question, but "Shall we get on with it, Mr. Sherborne?" struck her as ridiculous. "When do we..." wasn't much better, but she hoped it was soon. Very soon.
"You make me ache," Sherborne said, flexing his hips. "You make me ache and rejoice."
He rearranged himself so Charlotte lay on her back beneath him as he slid that part of himself against her sex. His slow caress sent need clamouring through her. "Again, please." A silent conversation took place between his body and hers. He teased, he dared, he hesitated, and Charlotte moaned against his neck. All else fell away as Sherborne shifted the angle of his hips and positioned himself to join with her. The act was strange, physical, and unrelentingly intimate. Sherborne eased his way into her body, and the yearning that had swamped Charlotte tangled up with tenderness for the man in her arms. "Don't be so careful," she murmured. "Be passionate with me." He brushed her hair back from her forehead.
"You're managing?"
How odd to trade words when nothing separated them. "I want to worship you with my body too, Lucas." He hitched closer, and pleasure welled from where they were joined.
"Move with me, Charlotte."
How could they move when... Oh. Oh. He set a tempo like war drums, slow, resonant, full of leashed power and unwavering focus. Charlotte matched him, scooting down to lock her ankles at the small of his back. Her touch wandered everywhere, the span of his shoulders, the taper of his waist, the slightly warm, raised bruise along his hip. As close as they were, she wanted to be closer, to be inside him the way he was inside her. Desire became a madness, obliterating all else. Fears, worries, dignity, even dreams fell beneath Sherborne's passion, until Charlotte lost her very self in pleasure.
Her awareness clung to one reality. Sherborne was with her. With her in pleasure, and with her in the panting, thunderstruck aftermath, as she curled beneath him, and his heartbeat reverberated with her own. Puzzle pieces fell into place. This was what lay behind a thousand glances passed between Charlotte's cousins and their spouses. This closeness was where families began, where every marriage was both the same and unique. This was what a ruined woman sacrificed her future for. Not the bodily sensations, amazing though they were, but the tenderness and cherishing, the oneness. Sherborne's breathing slowed, and though he remained close, he braced his weight on his elbows. Charlotte wanted to hold him tightly, because on the heels of all these revelations came a tide of gratitude toward her husband. She might have missed this. She might have spent the rest of her days shooting arrows through the hats of randy bachelors and turning down proposals from fortune hunters. She might have never known this wonder, never experienced the profound relief of putting aside every burden and hope to be one with her spouse for a few moments. She kissed his biceps. "What does one say after that?" He traced her eyebrow with his nose.
"One says, 'Lucas, fetch me a glass of water, please.'
No one did not.
'I'm glad I married you.'
He went still, mid-nuzzle.
'I'll bring you a flannel.'
Perhaps one didn't admit to being glad to be married either. Charlotte would ponder that puzzle later, when she didn't feel so relaxed, or had marriage made her balmy, cheerful. Sherborne brought her a damp cloth, then disappeared behind the privacy screen. Charlotte tended to herself, tossed the cloth over the privacy screen, and pulled up the covers.
"Come back to bed, Lucas."
By the light of the dying fire, he emerged from the privacy screen in his dressing gown.
"I'm off to the library for a bit. Thought I'd read over some correspondence. Let you get to sleep."
Charlotte's first reaction to Sherborne's plan was hurt, that he'd be capable of rising from their bed and turning his attention to, what, ledgers, reports from the solicitors, after making love with her like that. But another theory presented itself, one having to do with the privacy necessary to contemplate a marriage he might be re-evaluating, even as Charlotte was.
"Mr. Sherborne, for once, you will ignore the siren call of your commercial ventures and get some rest. You've earned it, and you will need your strength in the coming days and nights."
He stared at his bare feet.
"I will."
"Most assuredly. Come to bed, Lucas."
He came to bed. Sherborne waited until Charlotte dropped off to sleep to spoon himself around her. He should be in the library making calculations, revising estimates, figuring the cost of the extra labour Radnor and Haverford were providing. He should be searching for a replacement for Hannibal Jones, or for a competent assistant, though that would be another extra expense. He should be finding more investors. He should be...
"Lucas,"
Charlotte murmured.
"I thought you were asleep."
She rolled over to face him.
"I was. I dreamed of you. Can't you sleep?"
He was exhausted, and yet he could not reach for sleep, so he'd reached for her.
"I don't need much rest."
Charlotte came to him, burrowing closer, tangling her legs with his.
"You will need more rest in the coming months. Marriage will take a toll on your energies."
"Bold talk, Mrs. Sherborne."
"I like it when you call me Mrs. Sherborne."
He really ought to be in the library, not wasting half the night cuddling around his warm, gardenia-scented, curved in all the right places wife.
"I cannot neglect my business, Charlotte. Not for anything. If the mind doesn't soon get on its feet..."
She commenced drawing slow circles on his chest with her index finger.
then the mine fails. This valley has never had a mine, so nobody is any worse off than if the mine had never been attempted.
Nobody but me and my investors, and you.
Haverford will never cease gloating if the mine isn't thriving by this time next year.
So this determination where the colliery is concerned is about your pride.
The success of the mine was purely about pence and quid now.
A man should always take pride in his endeavours.
What about a woman? Is she allotted any pride?
Sherborne kissed her, because he wasn't equal to a debate on gender differences at this hour. Charlotte returned the kiss and then lay on her back, urging him to settle against her side. The position was novel, with Sherborne's cheek pillowed on her breast, her fingers playing with the hair at his nape.
"We must find a balance, Lucas, between your infernal obsession with immediate business and the long-term endeavours that will aid your interests over the course of a lifetime."
Her touch was so sweet, so soothing, and yet she was speaking to him in imperatives.
"Hard work aids my business endeavours."
She kissed his temple.
Was it hard work that inspired Haverford to relent regarding the mine? No, it was not. You attended his house party, comported yourself like a perfect gentleman, rescued that hopeless Miss Twit from the lake, entertained me when I was bored, and flirted with a few wallflowers. Haverford had to see you as something other than his vexatious creditor.
Charlotte traced the curve of Sherborne's ear, then used her thumb and forefinger to pull gently on his earlobe. The sensation was exquisitely relaxing, which was no help at all when she was already befuddling him with her pillow talk.
"I attended that house party on the barest pretense of an invitation, because I was considering an offering for Lady Glenys."
Charlotte's grip on his earlobe became quite firm.
"Are you besotted with her? She is a duke's daughter and the sister of a duke. You lose your common sense in the presence of titles, Lucas. I'll not have you pining for thy neighbour's marchioness."
"I was besotted with the idea that Haverford would have to choose between economic ruin or approving of me as a match for his sister. You have not married a saint, Charlotte."
Her grip eased.
"I have not married the scourge of the High Toby. Haverford is a duke, and they can leave a trail of aggravation that stretches for miles, one which they seldom notice. Elizabeth will have her hands full with Haverford. You mustn't be too hard on him, though. He hasn't had family about in any quantity to help him go on."
"And Sherborne had?"
"That tickles," Charlotte said, "when you flutter your eyelashes like that."
"I do not flutter my eyelashes."
"And yet you tickled me. We should call on the vicar."
Calling on the vicar would not clear the mud from what was to have been the high street at the works. Calling on the vicar would not revise the project estimates waiting for Sherborne in the library. Calling on the vicar would not do a damned thing to solve any relevant problem, though it would give Sherborne another hour in his wife's company.
"Why take tea with the vicar? He comes to Sherborne Hall annually to secure my donation to whatever fund he pretends to manage for the widows and orphans."
Charlotte traced her fingertip over Sherborne's lips.
"If you don't like how the funds are managed, you pay a visit to the vicar and indicate that your lady wife is in want of charitable projects. I insinuate myself onto the committee that oversees the money and take matters in hand. This is part of why you married me."
Sherborne let his eyes drift closed, because he could think just as well that way as with them open.
"What is part of why I married you? To run the local parish?"
"To be your eyes and ears in places you do not or cannot frequent. To add to the store of intelligence with which you make decisions."
"You'd spy for me?
Hardly honourable, Mrs. Sherborne." Though Charlotte had a point, he had offered for her because she'd opened doors previously closed to him. He hadn't considered that one of those doors would lead to the church committee room.
"I would be mindful of my husband's interests because I vowed to honour him, That means giving the dear fellow the benefit of my insights from time to time.
You're putting the dear fellow to sleep. Sending him into the loveliest, most relaxed doze, better even than the sweet, sleepy, post-coital stupor he'd wallowed in earlier for 2 entire minutes. And she'd called him dear, albeit half in jest.
I'm enjoying my marital privileges. You need your rest, Lucas.
He needed to be in the library. We can visit the vicar soon, after Brantford has worked his mischief, and the colliery is no longer at 6s and 7s.
Charlotte said something he didn't quite catch, about being patient with great lummoxes stuck in the mud of their own making. Could she have said that? And then he was dreaming of a red velvet sofa, one without lumps, that could accommodate a newly married couple in all their intimate enthusiasms.
Chapter 14. Halewyn was particularly subdued as she laced Charlotte up. Perhaps the housekeeper had had a word with the maid about proper decorum where handsome young grooms were concerned.
"This is a very fetching carriage dress," Halewyn said. "That shade of velvet makes me think of melted chocolate."
"Velvet is marvellous for keeping warm," Charlotte replied.
Sherborne was accomplished at keeping Charlotte warm, moving with her in a cosy rhythm throughout the night. He'd left in the morning before she'd risen, the wretch. At least she needn't guess where he'd got off to. Halewyn tied off the laces.
"Shall I ask Morgan to bring the dog-cart around, ma'am?"
"I'll send a footman to the stables."
"It wouldn't be any trouble at all to pop out to the carriage house and tell him."
Did Morgan know how devoted Halewyn was?
"You and Morgan can bring the bread and soup around at midday. Dress warmly, Halewyn, for I don't trust that sun to keep shining."
"Aye, ma'am."
Halewyn had taken to wearing a shawl, which might simply be an accommodation the maids were permitted as winter approached, though Charlotte hadn't seen any of the other maids wearing shawls. Charlotte took a chill easily, which Papa claimed was generally true of redheads.
"The letters on my vanity should go out with today's post. If you could take them into the village for me, I'd appreciate it."
"I'll just leave them on the sideboard in the front hall, shall I? Whoever goes into the village to pick up the post usually drops off whatever mail we're sending."
The girl was either feather-brained or outrageously smitten with her swain.
"We have discussed this, Halewyn. I want those letters taken straight to the posting inn. I do not want them lying about on the sideboard, visible to any passing servant or caller."
"Or husband?"
"Aye, ma'am."
Halewyn withdrew a brown wool cloak from the wardrobe.
"The kitchen is all in a swither to be entertaining his grace and his lordship tomorrow. Haven't ever had such fine company here at Sherborne Hall."
"They are family, Halewyn. They will call frequently. The kitchen needn't take any particular pains."
"We don't have many guests here at all, ma'am. Vicar comes once a year or so. Some of the squires, who owe Mr. Sherborne money, will join him for a meal. Nobody special."
Charlotte slipped into her cloak and drew a bright red scarf from the wardrobe. This time of year, the slightest breeze could bring a profound chill, even when the sun shone.
"You must never discuss the family's finances, Halewyn. Not with Morgan, not with anybody. I'm sure you wouldn't mention a neighbour's indebtedness before anybody but me, and Mr. Sherborne is owed your utmost discretion otherwise."
Halewyn looked as if Charlotte had threatened to turn her off without a character.
"I beg your pardon. I would never talk out of turn."
Now, there was a complete work of fiction.
"I'll be back this afternoon. Bring lunch to the site promptly at noon.
If I'm to go with Morgan and he's driving you there, then how—"
"I'm driving myself."
Rather than allow the maid to interrogate her, for Halewyn would at least make an attempt, Charlotte swept from the room. She stopped by the kitchen to collect some buttered bread, cheese, and a flask of hot tea, then made her way to the carriage house.
"Wouldn't be any trouble at all to drive you, ma'am," Morgan said, as Charlotte took the reins. "Mr. Sherborne might rather I did."
"Thank you, Morgan. But I need you to help Halewyn bring lunch to the works again. I'm a competent whip, and will inform Mr. Sherborne of that fact, should he raise a question. She clucked to the horse, who set off at a businesslike walk down the lane. The road was far from dry, but it was no longer a glorified marsh, and thus Charlotte was shortly at the colliery, where for once nobody was shouting. The men were making rapid progress clearing the lane, picks and shovels raising a racket, and in Mr. Jones's white tent Charlotte found only the Duke of Haverford, seated by the parlour stove. "Your Grace, good day." He rose and bowed. "Mrs. Sherborne, you must call me Charlotte, for we're family. I don't suppose you have seen my husband?"
Haverford was a good-looking devil,
though a bit too full of his consequence for Charlotte's taste. Elizabeth was smitten with him, though, so the Duke had Charlotte's approval, too. Up to a point.
Jones and Sherborne marched off to argue about relocating the workers' housing, and Radnor went along to referee. I'm reviewing progress reports, such as they are.
With only the masons on site and much to be done, I am sure progress has been slow.
Haverford brought a second chair over to the parlour stove.
Perhaps you'd like to have a seat.
Why have only masons on site, I ask myself. Why not hire labourers as well?
The masons brought their apprentices and hod carriers, from what I saw, and labourers cost money. Are you hoping my husband will fail, Your Grace?
The question was combative, but Charlotte had had a wonderfully cosy night's rest, and somebody had to take Haverford in hand if he was intent on sabotaging the mine.
Elizabeth warned me you were fierce.
Elizabeth was being polite, Your Grace. I am unrelenting when it comes to protecting those I care about. Mr. Sherborne is at these works in all weather. Up until all hours, with his schedules and budgets, he and I have had no wedding journey because he could not leave the works unattended any longer. And now his dratted business partner must arrive, like the bad fairy at the christening, and make a challenging situation worse.
If you intend anything less than the best of good faith and neighbourly goodwill toward these works, say so now.
Haverford's expression had gone blank. But what had Charlotte expected? That a duke, doubtless among those named to succeed to the British throne, would scurry off like a chastened schoolboy?
"He's here at all hours?"
Haverford asked, hands behind his back.
"And then up for yet more hours in the library, poring over ledgers and correspondence. If you think Mr. Sherborne an idle wastrel, you are much mistaken."
"I never thought him idle. In fact, he's a bit too industrious. He has his fingers in every pie, from the coaching inn to mortgages on half the farms in this valley."
This bothered Haverford, who doubtless had tenants on the other half.
"Do you want the mine to fail?" Charlotte asked.
"That would be ungentlemanly."
"So you do want the mine to fail? Why?"
Haverford gestured again to the chair, and Charlotte realized that his gentlemanliness also prevented him from sitting when a lady stood, or paced, or tidied up stacks of paper that admitted of no order whatsoever. She sat.
"I have placed my trust in Sherborne," Haverford said. "I hope he does not disappoint me. Others in this valley expect to find employment at this mine, but what I've seen so far is not encouraging. Then there's this Lord Brantford getting involved, when he has his own collieries to tend to in the north. I've also... well, let's leave it at that, shall we? I have reservations."
Haverford had been poking about, in other words, gathering intelligence on Charlotte's spouse.
"Then you owe it to Mr. Sherborne to share those reservations. He has not undertaken this mine because he needs another distraction, or is in want of coin. He's opened the mine because without it, this valley will become another forgotten Welsh backwater, remembered only in London pub songs."
That was going too far. No corner of the realm that boasted a ducal family seat would ever be entirely forgotten.
"You'd have me attribute charitable impulses to Lucas Sherborne?"
And that was going beyond too far.
"Need I remind you, Your Grace, that my own sister's determination to put a lending library in every Welsh coal town is funded by no less a person than Lucas Sherborne? Charlotte pulled off her gloves and stopped short of smacking them across the Duke's handsome cheeks. Sherborne had been a very lenient creditor to the St. David family, which was probably why Haverford's support of the mine was so grudging. "You need not remind me of Elizabeth's lending libraries, ever. I have wondered if she married me simply to get her hands on my books."
"Surely you jest, Haverford. She has more or less given your books away. Well, she seems quite attached to you."
One corner of his mouth kicked up, and he crossed his boots at the ankle. "As I am attached to her, Elizabeth is very pleased to have you for a neighbour. I've suggested you might want some time to settle in before she becomes a regular fixture in your parlour." Charlotte did not know Haverford well, but this conversation was encouraging. He was just another healthy, busy, besotted man, and the Wyndham family boasted a surfeit of same.
"I will no sooner be settled in than dear Mama will arrive for the winter holidays, a month or two early. She loves Wales, and now she has two more reasons to spend time here."
"Soon to be three," Haverford said, looking smug. Oh yes, he was family. Title or no title, Julian St. David had become family. The tent flap was thrown open to admit Lord Radnor and Sherborne, with Hannibal Jones bringing up the rear.
"Mrs. Sherborne, good day."
Sherborne offered a bow, and Charlotte decided the moment wasn't right to kiss his cheek. He looked delectably wind-blown and thoroughly annoyed.
"With her?"
"Ma'am," Radnor bowed as well, "a pleasure to see you. My lady and I are looking forward to your hospitality tomorrow evening."
"You are my rehearsal audience," Charlotte said. "I appreciate your courage, and I'm sure your company will be lovely too. So where are we putting these houses?"
All four men exchanged glances.
"I say, put them where they were," Mr. Jones replied. "The retaining wall won't give way a second time if it's properly reinforced, and putting the houses there saves us having to build any more dratted roads." "First, you'll have to move all that mud,"
Radnor retorted.
"Tons and tons. And that's effort that could be spent laying foundations, sinking a shaft, or building the tram line."
Jones took a deep breath, clearly filling his sails to defend his position.
"I'd like to hear my wife's suggestion," Sherborne said. "Women bring a different perspective to the whole matter of domestication."
Now the other three men looked at him, Jones incredulous, Radnor amused, and Haverford politely agog, while Sherborne regarded Charlotte calmly.
"My suggestion would be along the top of the North Ridge."
"Then we can't excavate any levels up there,"
Jones began, referring to mines dug laterally into the side of a hill.
"Need I remind you that the purpose of these works is to extract coal from the—" "We aren't planning on digging any levels," Radnor retorted. "Not for at least the next 5 years. And we have hills to the east and west if levels for some reason become imperative."
"Nothing about this mine is imperative," Haverford growled. "Not one damn single thing. But the miners must have decent housing if this project goes forward. Mrs. Sherborne, can you show us where you have in mind?"
With disagreement from all sides, no wonder Sherborne was worried. And that was before Haverford had started making unpleasant innuendos about the mine's sole investor. Charlotte abruptly wanted to trot back to the house and spend the day writing letters to her sisters in Scotland.
"Of course she can show us where she'd like to see the houses built," Sherborne said. "Madam?"
He gestured to the tent flap, and Charlotte preceded the men into the brisk sunshine.
"Up there," she said, shading her eyes and pointing. "Two rows of houses will fit easily, without encroaching on the pasture. One can see the ocean from that hilltop, and drainage won't be a problem."
Neither would failed retaining walls or a contaminated well. Jones sputtered about having to build a track up the side of the hill, for the houses wouldn't raise themselves, and Radnor countered with an observation that nothing was being built anywhere as long as certain people insisted on arguing away half the morning.
"Let's have a look," Haverford said, striding away in the direction of the path up the hill. "Using skilled masons to move mud is an abomination against the natural order, and damned slow work."
"You're right, of course," Sherborne said.
No mason has ever had to do a spot digging, square up a foundation trench, or deal with mud and mortar.
Showbourne went off with the Duke, arguing all the while, and Jones and Radnor followed, bickering like a pair of tipsy washerwomen. Charlotte trailed along behind the men, grateful that she'd worn sturdy boots, and resentful that her husband had to defend himself from accusations flung by a duke who'd probably never lifted a shovel in his titled life. Halfway up the hill, Charlotte realized that she had landed herself in a pickle. The last time she'd travelled this path, she'd had her husband's entire focus and held hands with him. She hadn't given the height a thought, a miracle she'd consider later. Now Sherborne was remonstrating with Haverford 30 yards ahead, closer to the summit. To Charlotte's left, the hillside rose steeply, while to her right— "Do not look," she muttered, "do not look. You are safe. The ground is solid beneath your feet. You have been this way before, and Sherborne is counting on you." She looked, and, no surprise, the works appeared tiny at the foot of the hill. The men were miniature figures digging through the great mass of earth that had obliterated the planned housing site. The stacks of equipment were so many toys strewn about, and the white tent sat in the middle, much, much too distant. Charlotte forced herself to gaze up the path, though now Sherborne was 40 yards away. Her heartbeat became painful, and her breathing inadequate to fill her lungs. If she fell— "Mister—" Her voice came up barely above a whisper, and vertigo threatened her balance. "Mr. Sherborne—" He couldn't hear her, not with the distance and wind. He'd soon round the last curve of the path and be lost to sight. Charlotte would die, lifted off the hillside by a gust of wind, and dropped onto the hard ground far below. Panic threatened.
"Lucas, please help!"
The ground lurched, though of course it hadn't really.
"Do not look. Sit down," Charlotte lectured herself. "Sit down right here, right now, and the men will find you when they are finished arguing, or when spring comes, or when—I can't do this."
Those four men would never cease arguing, and when they found her, Sherborne would be mortified that his wife couldn't even traverse a Welsh hillside without turning into a blithering ninny. Charlotte could not move, could not turn her head, could not figure out how to sink to her knees without toppling down the incline to her right. She could only gaze up the path at her husband's retreating form, hating her weakness, and wishing she'd never thought to intrude into matters beyond her ken. Though building the houses in the middle of the colliery itself had been a truly daft idea.
"Charlotte!"
Sherborne's voice. He was jogging back down the path, coming nearer with each step.
"Charlotte, are you well?"
She closed her eyes. He might misstep. He might go plummeting over the side of the hill. He might twist his ankle on a loose rock. He might—
"I've got you,"
Sherborne said, wrapping her in his arms.
"Say something. You're pale as the angel Gabriel's wings. Please, say something."
"Hold me," which came out as meep. He was warm, he was solid, and Charlotte could breathe. She cried again.
"I am being ridiculous."
"I should not have left you without an escort. The height is bothering you, isn't it? Damn it! What was I thinking? I'll have you down the hill in a trice."
Charlotte shook her head.
"I should be able to do this. This is merely a hill."
"It's a damned high hill, with a good drop if you take a wrong step. Damn it, damn it, blast and damn it!"
Charlotte gradually realized that Sherborne was more upset than she was. For him, she could muster some calm, provided he kept his arms around her.
"I have been up this hill before," she said. "If your miners are to dwell on the summit, I will be here frequently. Shall we proceed?"
"Are you sure?"
She loved him for asking that, for the concern in his voice, for the earnest regard in his blue eyes. He'd asked her the same question in bed last night, but this time seemed even more significant.
"I am quite sure. Hold my hand, and we shall contrive."
He not only held her hand, he walked on the outer side of the path, talked to her about Radnor's argument earlier with Jones regarding the tram line, and step by step got her to the hilltop. Every inch of the way, Charlotte held her husband's hand until she was at the summit, pacing off a row of houses and mentally laying out gardens and chicken coops, while trying to ignore the burning revelation that she loved her husband.
"I didn't think they were a love match,"
Radnor said as Sherborne and his lady sauntered down the hill hand in hand. "Why do you conclude they are?" Haverford countered.
"When was the last time you remained hand in hand with your duchess in public for a good half hour?"
"You ask a very personal question, Radnor. You're newly married yourself. Draw your own conclusions." The wind at the top of the hill was brisk, which Charlotte had pointed out would dry laundry quickly. The breeze was also likely to be free of coal dust, given that the prevailing direction was from land toward the sea. Fresh air was healthier for all concerned, and the air where the houses had originally been laid out would not have been fresh at all. Even Sherborne hadn't seen that, but neither had Haverford, Radnor, or Jones.
"I hold hands with my marchioness with lovely frequency," Radnor said, "though seldom in public. Sherborne has fallen for that red-haired dragoness."
Haverford felt an odd affection for Charlotte Wyndham. She was bold, awkward, and, most unexpected, ferociously protective of her new husband. What had Lucas Sherborne done to deserve such a champion, much less a woman bristling with intelligence and sense?
"The red-haired dragoness is my sister by marriage, Radnor. She and Sherborne do seem to suit. Unlike Sherborne and Jones. Did Sherborne explain to you Jones's error with the retaining wall?"
Sherborne and his bride, still hand in hand, disappeared around a bend in the path.
"No explanation yet, and one doesn't want to ask. Sherborne is devilish prickly where I am concerned."
Radnor had been friends with Haverford since they'd been breached, and now, having married Haverford's sister, Radnor was family. They had few secrets, though Haverford was prepared for marriage to change their friendship.
"You are devilish prickly where Sherborne is concerned," Radnor retorted. "You haven't any coin invested in this venture. You have no expertise with mining. So what exactly do you think your hovering about accomplishes?"
"I can't hover about my duchess every hour of the day. The lady needs her rest." Radnor punched him on the arm.
"Admit you are worried for Sherborne. Jones isn't the engineering paragon he presents himself to be, not if he forgets to calculate the weight of rainwater in topsoil when designing a retaining wall."
"Good God. Is that what went wrong?"
"Charlotte Sherborne figured it out, and thank the angelic choruses, Sherborne listens to her. She has good ideas."
She was also pretty, in a robust, severe way. Elizabeth was prettier, of course. "Mrs. Sherborne knows as much about mining as I do. If Jones is incompetent, he'll have to be replaced."
"He's probably a decent mining engineer, but no sort of architect. I've dabbled in the occasional design project, enough to draw a few elevations."
"Jones hasn't?" Radnor gazed down at the great heap of earth lying atop the planned street. Whole trees had come along with the side of the hill, and were now standing upright 100 yards from where they'd been last week.
"Jones has never designed a dwelling, or a surface structure of any kind, and did not admit his limitations, until they were obvious. He needs this post, I suspect, and I'm making inquiries in Swansea and Cardiff regarding his work history. I also consulted with Glenys regarding Lord Brantford."
Radnor had been busy, in other words, while Haverford had been not much help at all. What did Glenys have to say?
"Brantford married an heiress, or so he thought. Turns out the woman's family had put every available groat into her settlements, and their fortunes have continued to decline since she married Brantford."
These things happened. They'd happened to Haverford's own family for the past 100 years.
"Is Sherborne supposed to send coin pouring into the Earl's family coffers?"
Radnor's gaze dropped to his boots, which were wet from tromping about the hilltop.
"Sherborne has a fine grasp of finances, Haverford. I invested in this mine because I've made money with him on two previous projects, though I resorted to intermediaries to handle the details."
"You're not suggesting I invest in the mine?"
"If you're not an investor, and you know nothing about mining, then what in blazes are you doing here?"
Radnor's tone was mild, but then his tone was always mild when he was delivering a coup de grace. Only fools underestimated Cedric Radnor. Fools, and occasionally best friends.
"I don't know, but sometimes a disinterested third party has a useful perspective. Witness Charlotte's opinions about the houses. What do we do about Jones?"
"We watch him closely. Find somebody to review all of his calculations. Let Sherborne know that engineers are employees, not dictators."
"I can help with that last part. Where has Jones got off to?"
"The coaching in. Griffin says he's there rather a lot."
Griffin had passed that along to Radnor, rather than to his own brother. "I'm off to have a word with Griffin, and I'll see you tomorrow night. Elizabeth will probably inveigle Glenys into helping with the lending library scheme."
"Glenys will have to dodge that fire on her own, for her grace has already sent out the press gangs after my handsome self."
Haverford started down the hill. "Do you suppose the climb truly winded Charlotte? She seems a healthy woman."
"Who knows? Perhaps she was laced too tightly. Sherborne's concern was real."
"True. And seeing Lucas Sherborne in a flat panic over a woman who could literally shoot a man's arrows out of the sky had relieved an anxiety Haverford didn't entirely understand.
"Elizabeth loves those lending libraries," Haverford said,
"and they are being established largely because of Sherborne. If anything happens to him or his fortunes, my Duchess will take it amiss." Radnor kept right on walking.
"Oh, of course, the lending libraries. If anything happens to Her Grace's little sister, your Duchess will take it much worse than amiss, and Her Grace's little sister seems much taken with Sherborne."
Ergo, nothing awful must happen to Sherborne. As distasteful as the duty to safeguard his venture will be, you have the right of it. For the sake of my Duchess, Sherborne's interests must be guarded. That logic worked as well as any, though Elizabeth would see right through it. Chapter 15. Charlotte was poised and relaxed, to appearances, as her dinner guests moved from the formal parlour into the dining room. As hostess, she took Haverford's arm, leaving Sherborne to escort the Duchess.
"Is Charlotte as happy as she seems?" Her Grace murmured.
"You should ask her," Sherborne replied. "I pray she'll answer in the affirmative."
"She's your wife, sir. I hope you'll trouble yourself to read her moods."
Sherborne allowed the Duchess her scold, because she spoke as a concerned sister, not as Her Grace of Haverford.
"We have been married barely a fortnight, and we had no courtship at the insistence of the bride's family. If I do not presume to speak for my wife's happiness, I am acknowledging my ignorance as a new husband, not my indifference."
"You'll suit," the Duchess said, patting his arm. "Charlotte thrives on confrontation and challenge."
"No, she does not. Charlotte thrived on solving problems, on being of use, though her talents were not those a lady typically cultivated. Thank God." Griffin St. David, escorting his sister, Lady Radnor, nearly collided with them at the door to the dining room. He grinned, bowed, and let Sherborne escort the Duchess to her seat. Lady Griffin was on Radnor's arm, though in this company Charlotte had decided the couple would be addressed as Griffin and Biddy. By extension, they were Sherborne's family now, too, the pick of the lot in his estimation. The dining room was large enough to hold 30 at supper, though Charlotte had had all the extra leaves removed from the table. Bowls of heartsease served as centerpieces, and two footmen stood by the sideboard. The meal would be informal, and thus conversation could fly in all directions. Sherborne suspected this was how the Wyndham family typically dined. His correspondence that morning had included letters from two of Charlotte's titled cousins, both earls, while Charlotte had received letters from one sister and yet another cousin, a duchess and a marchioness.
"Now we all sit down," Griffin announced, "and we have witty conversation."
He beamed at the company as if pleased to instruct them.
"Exactly so," Sherborne said, "and we enjoy good food as well. Haverford, I nominate you, as the ranking title, to lead the witty repartee."
The Duke left off goggling at his duchess long enough to deliver a pointed stare in Sherborne's direction.
"Surely that is mine host's privilege."
"We had a lovely visit with the vicar yesterday," Charlotte said. "Miss Macpherson is a delightful young lady, very dedicated to supporting her papa's work."
The lovely visit had consisted of tepid, weak tea served with small, stale cakes, and not many of them. Charlotte had finagled an invitation to join the ladies' charitable committee, while Sherborne had endured Mr. Macpherson's innuendos about christenings that followed too soon after weddings.
"We should find Miss Macpherson a fellow," the Duchess said, "or she'll be her father's unpaid curate for the rest of her days."
"Maybe she likes life at the vicarage," Charlotte countered. "Not every woe is solved by marriage."
"My every woe has been solved by marriage," Griffin was in complete earnest, and his comment earned smiles and laughter.
Biddy blew him a kiss across the table. Most unladylike behaviour, but then why not let her husband know he was appreciated?
"If we're looking for spouses," Griffin went on, "couldn't we find one for Maureen Cardenwell? She has a baby, so she should have a husband."
Haverford, Radnor, Lady Radnor and the Duchess all reached for their wine glasses simultaneously.
"A fine notion," Charlotte said, "one that speaks well of your kind-heartedness, Griffin. If we can't find the young woman a husband, perhaps you could spare her some chickens."
"We have lots of chickens," Griffin replied. "Biddy and I will take Miss Cardenwell some hens. Then the baby can have eggs. We'll bring a big basket, as big as the one Miss Charlotte sent, and just as full of good things."
"We'll do it tomorrow,"
Biddy said,
"unless it rains."
"If it rains, we'll go the day after tomorrow."
Griffin and Biddy shared a gaze of such mutual approval, Sherborne could not look away. They were a couple completely without artifice, entirely besotted, and entirely unconcerned what anybody thought of them. Though, when had Charlotte had time to send a basket to the local fallen woman?
"Would anybody like more wine?" Radnor asked. "At the mention of rain this time of year, all I can think is snow would be worse."
The weather served its usual purpose, and various courses were presented and removed, until the ladies abandoned the menfolk. Sherborne, having been instructed by Charlotte previously, escorted the women to the family parlour, which private moment gave him a chance to receive fresh orders from his wife.
"I trust you will manage without us men for a short time," Sherborne said, "and I won't allow the gentlemen to tarry too long with their port."
He bowed over Charlotte's hand and would have returned to the dining-room, but Charlotte kept his fingers clasped in hers.
"Kiss my cheek," she muttered.
Her back was to the ladies. Nobody else would have heard her quiet words. Sherborne did as she bid, which had the other three ladies smiling at him. He kissed Charlotte's other cheek as well, one good kiss deserving another, and then left the women to their tea and talk. He passed through the foyer on his way back to the dining-room, and noticed correspondence sitting in the salver on the sideboard. Charlotte, for the direction was in her hand, had written to a Harold Porter, who had the great misfortune to dwell in a godforsaken corner of Brecknockshire. Three other letters lay beneath the epistle to Mr. Porter. One to Mrs. Wesley Smythe, one to Mrs. Scott Wesley, a third Mrs. Morton Wesley. Interesting. Charlotte wrote only to family that Sherborne knew of, and no Wyndhams rusticated in Brecknockshire. He was tempted to pocket the letters and study them further, but Griffin poked his head out of the dining-room at that moment and motioned Sherborne down the corridor. He rejoined the gentlemen, who were looking more forlorn than relieved to have parted company with their ladies.
"Shall we to the decanter?" Sherborne asked. "I'm under strict orders from Mrs. Sherborne not to tarry over the port for more than 30 minutes."
His guests brightened. Griffin launched into an earnest panegyric to the Welsh laying hen, and Sherborne breathed a sigh of relief. His first dinner as host to multiple titles, even Griffin was a courtesy lord, was going well. Charlotte knew what she was about, and tomorrow Sherborne could get back to creating a mine where even nature seemed determined that he should not build one.
"You are quiet," Griffin observed. "Do you miss your wife? I miss Biddy."
"Might as well admit the truth," Radnor said. "We miss our ladies, don't we, Haverford?"
Haverford's smile was less than dignified. "Terribly. 8 minutes to go, though. Courage, lads." Sherborne was not a lad.
"Nothing says we must wait the full 30 minutes. This is an informal gathering of family, and we've discussed the weather enough to last us until spring. If the rest of you are too domesticated to storm the tea-tray, I am not."
The three other men rose as one, and Radnor finished his drink in a single swallow.
"Leon Macduff! And damned be him that first cries, 'Hold, for I'm too domesticated to storm a teapot!'"
"Is Radnor sozzled?" Griffin asked. "He'll have a sore head in the morning if he is."
"He's in love," Haverford said, heading for the door. "He'll be fine in the morning, if Glenys lets him out of bed." Griffin's beatific smile was back.
"Biddy sometimes won't let me—"
"To the parlour," Sherborne said. "I expect each of you to compliment my wife effusively on her hospitality."
"Right,"
Radnor said.
"Of course," Haverford added.
Griffin was already out the door. Sherborne followed, mostly pleased with the evening. Charlotte had been right. They'd needed a dress rehearsal, a family-only gathering for practice. That Haverford and Radnor were family still boggled Sherborne's mind. And yet, the evening had been disquieting as well. Charlotte had made no mention of sending a basket to the Cardenwell household, and she was writing to some man in Brecknockshire, whom she'd also never raised in conversation with her husband, also to several women who'd married men named Wesley. Charlotte had kept her fear of heights from her family's notice for years. What was she hiding from her husband, and why? The Earl of Brantford was a fine specimen of English nobility, blonde, above average height, with the pale blue eyes of the typical Saxon. Every instinct Haverford possessed told him Elizabeth had disliked the Earl on sight, though her manner had remained gracious throughout the introductions and ensuing small talk.
"If you gentlemen will excuse me," she said, rising, "I'll let the housekeeper know our guest has arrived."
Haverford bowed.
"Until dinner, my dear?"
The housekeeper had doubtless known the instant Brantford's coach had turned up the drive. Elizabeth was simply abandoning ship, doubtless off to enjoy a solitary nap, while Haverford was left to make yet more small talk with Sherborne's pet earl. Brantford offered the Duchess a bow as well, then resumed decimating the tea-tray.
"I hadn't realized you'd married such a beauty, Haverford. Never hurts when the wife is easy on the eyes, eh?"
The remark rankled, exceedingly.
"I beg your pardon?"
"Wait until you've been married a few years. The early days can be lively, but after that boredom sets in, particularly if your best efforts don't result in a full nursery. You're a duke. I needn't spell out the obvious."
Brantford wiggled his eyebrows while he munched a beef sandwich.
"Will you be staying with us long?"
Haverford asked. For the past hour had been among the longest he could recall.
"Dear me, of course not. Wales in winter? You must be daft. But then you are newly married. One and the same for some. I'm guessing Sherborne's nuptials were an entirely mercenary undertaking. I don't know the man well, but I've heard a few on dit regarding the new Mrs. Sherborne."
Haverford got up to toss more peat onto the fire, for the afternoon was growing chilly.
"Such as?" "You married into the same family.
The Wyndhams are well connected, but they aren't all as, shall we say, genteel as your lovely Duchess. Her sister is known to be outspoken, or so